KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. In just three seasons, the show Mad Men has become a real pop culture sensation. Its creator, Matthew Weiner, is here. We've been trying to get him forever. Matt, thanks so much for coming to do the show.
Thrilled to be here.
You probably heard this question a bunch of times, but when I remember seeing the first episode, I thought about that speech that Tony Soprano makes in the first episode of Sopranos, wishing for a return to the strong, silent type.
Everything about that show influenced me. I wrote this simultaneously, and all I thought was, if Tony Soprano strangles people, I think it's okay if this guy sells cigarettes. But I also thought, when you see a piece of art like that and its commercial success had not even been proved yet, I mean, that was even more gratifying that you could make something like that and that people – there was a market for it, because they always say, you know, the good things don't make any money. And you see something like that and it's this juggernaut and it was art. I was very much encouraged, and I felt very much – I feel when I see great entertainment like that, I feel less alone. The college episode was really where I was just intractably connected to that show. I thought I turned to my wife. I was like, do you know what he's doing here? Do you understand that the hero of the show is being true to his character, that there's no lie here? That was mind-blowing, in addition to all the other artistry of it, the great acting and great writing and humor and violence altogether.
But since we're talking about that, because I remember when David did the show, David Chase, I asked him, I said, when I saw the last episode of the first season, I thought was to date the best episode of TV I'd ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought you guys wrote it because you thought you weren't going to get picked up. And he said, are you kidding? If we thought we were going to get picked up, we wouldn't have like made Big Pussy a traitor. Of course we didn't think we were going to get picked up. And I almost felt to some extent that was the case with the first season of Mad Men, that you put a lot of your eggs in that basket, especially the penultimate episode of the first season.
I wanted to burn out the story that I had. I thought it was dishonest to stretch things out. And it was something, you know, trying to work contrary to television conventions. Those are, you know, you're working on the audience's expectations on one level, which is what their expectations are for story. You got to zig when they zag, and you don't want it to be predictable or anything like that. But you're also working against their television expectations. And Pete blackmailing Don is something that on a normal network TV show would have taken at least 9 episodes. It could have taken seasons, actually. And I did it in 15 minutes. And what I did, what I wanted to do was say, here's the theme of – here's the dramatic intent of that episode. What is it like to actually blackmail somebody? Because the reality is to actually do it, you have to – it's what Don says. If you have something bad enough on someone that you want to bend them to your will, you have to wonder what will they do to you? And people don't think that through, I think, when they blackmail. This thing with Letterman, you know, you look at it and you just say, what if he just decides to – he could turn around and kill you. He could turn around and do anything, you know. He could run. He could do whatever. So I really wanted to do that discomfort. I really wanted to – and then reveal it to the audience. And I was worried that revealing to – you know, I had the secret from the beginning. And I actually – when I was writing the first season, episode 5 is the one where his brother comes back. I wrote that after I had already done episode 6 and 7.
Really?
And I jammed it in between 4 and 6. Because I said I have this amazing secret for my main character and I'm keeping it from the office, but I'm also keeping it from the audience. And so I don't know if it's – I think when you hold back on things, it's like when you work on a pilot. All the time I've worked on a lot of pilots. I've gone in to do punch-up on a lot of half-hour pilots. That was one of my jobs for a long time.
You were a writer on
Becker. On a lot of sitcoms. I was a writer on Becker, Naked Truth, Andy Richter Controls the Universe, and I did a lot of shows that were 6 and out. But anyway, when you work on these in these pilots, people are always like, well, that's a good story, but I'm going to save that for episode 2. And I'm like, you know what? You may not have an episode 2. Use it up now. Use it now. And that's what I thought, you know. I will tell you, interestingly enough, on the last episode, the wheel episode with the carousel in it and everything, I did have a different ending in it originally. I had a much more permanent ending for that episode. And the network came to me and said, what are you doing? You're ending the series. You're not ending the season. And I just said, well, I don't know if I'm picked up. And I don't know where I'm going. As a writer, and this – it's hard to explain to people, but creative people understand this. But you physically feel a lot of the things that you write. And the ending that was in the carousel, not the speech necessarily, but the very, very ending of him coming home and his family being gone, that was a very painful thing for me to write, and I really didn't want to do it, even though it was supposed to be what was there. And the writing staff, Maria and Andre, a lot of people were like, she can't be there when he comes home. She has to be gone. It's not permanent, but he missed it. And so I had that scene of him coming home and having his – what the original ending was, he came home and the family was there, and then he and Betty were in the car. And I had this incredible sense memory of my childhood of driving, you know, with snow flurries on the windshield, and us asleep in the back seat and our jackets like freezing on the way there. And Betty saying, you know what, I don't want to see a psychiatrist anymore. I don't want to see the doctor anymore. Which, because the big thing was that she had revealed to the shrink that she knew that Don was having an affair, and theoretically the shrink was going to tell Don.
It's the treatment. My guest is Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. Because I felt at the beginning of the second season, you were almost sort of saying that Don was kind of at loose ends the same way the show is at loose ends. And when I remember seeing Frank O'Hara, I thought, wait, who puts Frank O'Hara? O'Hara's basically like kind of a quasi-beat and a poet who talked about taking in life and all about warmth and being who you are in any circumstance.
And Don wants to be that way, but Don is filled with pain and is medicating with sex and drugs and you know, cigarettes, and that's where he is. I think just because we can't do it doesn't mean we don't love it. And I think that the idea that he saw that guy reading that book in a bar, and the guy basically looks at it. It's all a lot about what Don, that Don's one thing on the inside and another thing on the outside. And I mean, I'm very interested in that, and I think that's the American story.
So we saw that in his ease with the Beatniks in the first season.
He can fit in anywhere. That's why he's good at advertising. He's kind of a cipher for that. And we also know he has this background. And I think a lot of the influential people in the 20th century are people who came from these backgrounds, and they obscured them.
Because I think of Don in a lot of ways as the experience you have in Los Angeles, unlike going to New York, is in Los Angeles you can recreate and you can make yourself into whatever you want to be, because it's a kind of an amorphous city. And in some weird way, the show feels like that kind of metaphor for Los Angeles. You come here, the city doesn't have an identity you have to blend into. You can make what you want it to be. And Don feels like that kind of person to me.
Yeah, I think you can do it anywhere in America. I think that's the story of America. That's, you know, look at Jay Gatz, right? You know, that's the story of America. This is not – I didn't make this up. You know, these people come here and they change their names, and – whether Ellis Island does it or whatever, and people raised in great shame and privation in the Great Depression who went on to be the leaders and the robber barons and the media leaders and the artists of the 20th century, and a lot of them were very, very secretive about their childhoods and their past, and they changed their names. And I, you know, fair or not, the greatest – the mobility in the United States really has to do with money. If you become successful financially, if you become that white male with that wallet, nobody's going to ask you where you're from. And you can flaunt it and be crude about it and say, I'm from here, but most people don't. Rockefeller, the original Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, spent his entire life trying to obscure this scandal in his family. And Nellie Bly eventually revealed it. But, you know, that's you know, look at that guy. You know, people think of him as – whether they like him or not, they do think of him as virtuous, and he is. But he's comes from this shameful past. And that mobility, which doesn't exist anywhere unless you, like, read, you know, The Red and the Black or something. Somebody becomes a priest and they get to move up, you know. But in America, you can really do it. You can steal your way to the top.
It's funny you bring up Stendhal, because he really is Julian, isn't he? He is Julian Sorrell.
Yeah, he is. It's an old character. He's part scoundrel. He's part
It was really evident in that penultimate episode of season 2, which feels almost like a horror movie version of Bonjour Tristesse, actually.
I mean, I wanted him to be cleansed. That's really what I was interested in. And he has these hillbilly roots, you know. He has this – the lack of faith and the lack of grounding, the existentialism – philosophically or emotionally is always at battle with the values that you're raised with. And they're both religions in the United States. There's a lot of people at the top who are extremely nihilistic and very interested in, well, that's not going to be my problem.
Was it Balzac who said that inside every cynic beats the heart of a romantic? And is that who Don is, kind of?
I think Don is a romantic person. It's right there in the pilot when he says to Rachel Menken, she says he says, you know, love doesn't exist. It was invented by guys like me to sell nylons. And you're born alone, you die alone. And, you know, everything else is just a bunch of rules they throw on top of you. And I'm not. I'm living for today. And he's very tough about it. It's very, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre writes the dialogue for him. He's very manly about it. And then she says, I don't know what it is you really do believe in, but I know what it's like to be disconnected, because she's this Jewish woman. And that he's unsettled by it. And it's one of the things that John Hamm, I knew right away, would be great in the part. It was written into the script that he looks down into his drink, which is a tell, you know. And he just sort of wipes his lips off and says, I don't know if that's true. And you can see that it's a great posture to take, but in the end, you don't know.
It's the treatment I'm talking to, the very moral Matthew Weiner. His series is Mad Men, and his third season on AMC. Because to me, the show feels finally, because Julian Sorrell is really the guy who's capable of anything until he has to really do the worst. And that's where Don's morality always comes into play. When the worst is demanded of him, he suddenly becomes – or he finds his moral center.
Or he's moral in the way most of us are, depending on the situation.
It's a sliding scale.
He's almost extremely moral with every person he deals with. His immorality comes in the conflict between the people. He, I feel, treats his mistresses with great, you know, dignity. And treats his wife with a great dignity. It's the duplicity that's the immorality. I think that he's an abused child, and I think at his core he hates himself, and I think that goes along with a lot of creative people and a lot of industry. You know,
I'm sorry, and a twinkle appears in your eyes.
No, I'm not saying I'm an abused child. I'm just saying I've been in writers' rooms for a long time, and the stories that you hear about how people gain perspective on the world usually comes from some extremely strange childhood.
But morality comes almost in that way that it does in Red Harvest, where you have a guy who's pitting two sides against each other, and he sort of decides, well, how violent can I be if I'm making two sides work against you? And again, in the most extreme circumstance is when his morality comes into play.
He did this act in Korea that was very cowardly. And I was very worried about him, you know, switching the dog tags and taking that man's identity, you know. And he set the fire. He was the one who panicked and dropped the light. He's responsible for it. And I was very worried because we had, first of all, a lot of vets on the show in different departments. And then I had an Army advisor come in because I wanted to get everything right, because you know how I am about it. And all of them were very grateful to me, as a lot of people are, for expressing the terror of being in combat and the survival skills that come in, and the fact that if you are in a ludicrous situation like that, it's not immoral to want to save your own life. And, you know, that to me was interesting, you know. But again, it's like you're saying, it's like, what are you capable of? Is there a scale? I mean, obviously it's immoral. You're breaking the law that everybody agrees on, it's immoral.
The show is, as much as anything, to me, about second-generation Americans and the price of assimilation.
That is definitely something I'm interested in. I will agree with you on that. It's definitely something big in that story is, what does it take to be an American? And what are you giving up? And, you know, growing up and going to college at the height of multiculturalism and saying, okay, we all have these virtues. We all have these pasts. They are – but in the end, success requires – especially for that generation. Rachel Menken's a great example. You know, just what is required. Forget about giving up your womanhood and having to be tough. Peggy has definitely had to do that. That was sort of the story of the first season, about her getting fat. Was literally about, she's been sexualized and she's going to become one of the boys. But Rachel Menken, that process of like, I'm going to give up a lot. And it always comes across as self-hate. You know, again, in the pilot, she says, why didn't you go to a Jewish agency? And she said, if I'd wanted someone from the same village as my father, I would have. It's so cruel. You know, and in the end, then there turns out to be all these amazing Jews in advertising. But it took a while for them to get into it.
We got to take a break. My guess is Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, is the treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back to The Treatment. My guess is Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men. I can't sit here and talk to you without talking about the way you dealt with race in the beginning of the second season, when it's kind of about Paul, and we see Joan's astonishing kind of subtle racism being used as both probably the way she came up and also as kind of brinksmanship.
I'm with the president on this. We should not pretend like this didn't happen. We should not pretend like it didn't exist, like everybody was together. I was trying to find pictures when we were building Megan's department store. I was trying to find pictures of New York City. And there, I see all kinds of black faces in Union Square, but I don't see any black faces on Fifth Avenue. I don't see them in Saks Fifth Avenue. And there was no one at the door keeping you from going into that store, and even the prices. But it was a parallel universe.
The reason I ask you about this, because I know the year of the show in terms of chronology, the riots are coming up in Newark, which will – I wonder if there's anyone –
What year are the riots in Newark?
They're 65.
Yeah, well, they're not really coming up yet, are they?
I don't know what – because you skip ahead a couple of years.
Sometimes I do. I don't want people to know, really. You know, I just watched Wuthering Heights the other night with my son, the 1939 version of Wuthering Heights. And I'm watching the movie, and the first 15 minutes of this movie involve showing the ramshackle Wuthering Heights, showing Laurence Olivier as an older man, his wife, and having this stranger come in who sees the ghost upstairs, which is the way the book starts, and then it's done in flashback. And this is the kind of stuff that nowadays in entertainment, they just lop it off. What am I doing? Get to it. Where's it going? I'm bored. What's going on? I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening. I think it's part of the DVD, the availability of media and being able to watch things over and over and over again, that people are uncomfortable with the story not knowing what's happening. That first time through is just so unsettling. I try and keep it a secret.
But I think people do want to be surprised by it. I just think institutionally now, there's such a fear of attracting an audience rather than just giving an audience a chance to find something, that people back away from alluring with secrets.
Look, you know, there's all kinds of entertainment. I always talk about, you know, the formula entertainment, Law and Order, which I love, you know, these things where you go and you – Agatha Christie, Spider-Man, you know, soap operas. You know you're going to hit these beats and the formula is there, and now we're all going to the drawing room where all shall be revealed. I love those things also. And there's a comfort to having little twists and turns along that train. But then there's another thing where you just say, are you ready for something new? Are you ready for something where there's enough genre that you can keep comfortable and there's enough of your people that you can – and they don't betray you too much, you know? But you do not know what's going to happen. And part of that is following these people through this period and their lives. And I don't want to necessarily know where they're going to go. I don't want to – you know what? I don't want to have the tail wag the dog too. I don't want the audience deciding what I do, because I don't think in the end that they know that they're the best judges of that. They always want more of this, more of that, and then when they get it, they're like, "Oh, it's too much of this and too much of that." You can't do it. You just got to do what you know, even if you're stupid about it, you just got to go with it. And you know, here's what's happened too. The audience has become more educated. The first season, everyone was like, "Who's going to win that 1960 election? Does Nixon win it? Does Kennedy win it?" They don't know. They weren't interested. The second season, when Marilyn Monroe died, people were like, "Oh, that's right. Marilyn Monroe died that year. I forgot about that." So now, you know, they know what's happening month by month. Will he cover this? Will he cover that? And there are two amazingly interesting things. One was trying to get the audience to understand that I'm resetting the story every year and it's going to be a new story and you got to forget a lot about what's happened and I'll bring it in if I can. But this is something new, story-wise. It's the same people, but I'm telling a different story. The next phase in their lives or something I'm interested in. The other thing is how we experience history. We don't know what's going to happen and we don't know what the most important events are of the day. And you can't look at the New York Times. You can't tell. Someone's going to write a great book about how the recession ended. And for all we know, it was, you know, the tide turned when GM went out of business 3 months ago. We don't know that. So you can't sit there and have people saying, you know, GM went out of business. I think the tide's turning. No one thought that. They thought, oh, my God, could it get any worse? How much do people really pay attention to the news and to history? I mean, there are some events that you can't avoid. But for the most part, there are people who are in the news business, but the rest of us, there are events that I've found in books that you can't even believe, you know, and somebody's going to make a movie about this kid in the balloon, right? Who the parents who pulled the hoax and put the kid in the balloon, and it harkens back to the most – there's a very famous child stuck in a well that was covered on the radio. You know, it's a blip. It's a blip a lot of times, and your personal life is really what's, you know.
Well, unless that big news affects your life, it just becomes something you talk about.
Does any news actually affect your life unless it literally affects your life?
It's The Treatment. My guest is Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. You're trying to make the show, and I hate to use this word, seem more experiential to people. Because one of the things I kind of noticed about it
is I'm definitely interested in that.
Is people remark on the physical beauty of other people, which you never see in TV shows.
I'm very interested in that. I'm very interested in that. And in calling out the reality of the fact that Don and Betty are gorgeous.
It happens in real life, but in TV, nobody ever makes mention of that.
Like, no,
it's,
they don't.
It's the way the
because
world is.
Because, you know, because they have – January Jones will be in another show playing the ugly girl. You know what I mean? This is the – I don't want to pretend like those people are normal, and I'm very interested in physical beauty and appearances, and I'm interested in the intimacy of human life. Someone said to me the other day that they like the show because it's like that moment where you like you flush the toilet and you wash your hands and you're about to open the door to go back into the room with all the other people, and you just have a moment before you go outside. That's on the show, that moment. I want to deal with things that actually are. And we have a lot of language and things like that to pretend like they aren't actually there. And whether beauty makes your life easier or harder or makes you have a different experience, everybody has a different experience and we'll never know what it is through those eyes. But I love the fact that from the beginning, Betty Draper is a vain woman. And her greatest concern after her mother's death is the realization that she will lose her looks and that that will be a kind of death.
Well, she really is almost like the kind of woman that Betty Friedan warned women not to be in that way.
I think you can warn people as much as you want. They didn't know they were suffering, I'll tell you to some degree, any more than anybody knows they're suffering. That was the ultimate job. It doesn't matter if you had just graduated from Radcliffe or even had whatever your achievement was as a woman, to find that handsome husband and have the house in the country and be devoted to raising your children and to civic duty. It was the primo job, and Betty Friedan is the one who talks about that. But there is it's an incredible waste of brain power, and it's hard to keep them down on the farm if you've been educated. It's, you know, I always say that there's this attitude when you read among men at that time, and also they have it about their children also besides their wives, which is don't let them chew through the rope. Don't let the dog chew through the rope. You got to let them have what they want once in a while, you know? But then there's the other thing that Don says. Who couldn't be happy with all that? Who could not be happy with all that? And that, to me, is the great conundrum of Betty Draper.
Well, I talked about the white man's hegemony, and that sort of your use of hegemony as being basically dominance over one specific group. And then white men is basically—
It's all a dominance of one specific group. And what's more interesting, and, you know, I'm not going to speak for your culture, I can speak for my culture, and I certainly can speak for Italians to some degree because I've been deep in that culture from being at The Sopranos, and I will speak for your culture as well. There is so much Irish people too. My God, there is so much for minorities in this country, and white or otherwise, and it is easier for the white ones. There is so much from the culture of who do you think you are? You do not belong there. What? Look at you trying to be a white man. And, you know— That, to me, is fascinating because we all make sacrifices to be that way. And it's part of the socialization process. It's part of becoming educated. It's part of being led into the halls of power. And it doesn't matter. I think it's interesting at this point, it's starting to become less dependent on your gender or your race or anything like that. You will be led in there, but you still have to behave that way. And you still will be judged by the people you come from by not being enough true to yourself, by not bringing enough of your culture with you, by adopting too much of that hegemony, of that white culture.
Because you're also saying the show, and it's just on the cusp of the time when the phrase selling out becomes a thing you don't want to do. For you, because that also seems to be part of the subtext too, of that line between selling out and selling.
That's why you can't be too hard on advertising. You just can't. Because it's there. It's talking about something that you already are. It's appealing to something that you've already developed in yourself. And a lot of times it's very positive. It's, God, I would like to be the kind of person who could buy a house and have that car, and that will make me a better person, or that will make me more handsome. And sometimes it's like, God, does everybody know how shallow, has everybody know how bad I smell? You know what I mean? But I do think that the selling out, I think it's hard to be a person. And I think our culture celebrates personhood at times, and because it has this mobility. And I feel like we want to believe in things and we want to be true to ourselves, and we get caught up. We fail a lot, you know? And the fact that we don't know it is even more painful, that other people can tell us about it. That's even more painful. But I always think that you can't be too hard on people for going after what they want sometimes. You just can't. You only go around once, and not that there's a virtue and you shouldn't crush people and not be aware of them, but a lot of people – most people don't do something bad because they're bad. They have a reason for it. You know, we had this episode where Don had to sign this contract, and he kept being reminded that he was that guy in the suit, that he was, hey, Cadillac, you know?
He literally had to have it beaten into him who he was.
He had it beaten into him, and, you know, that's why I ended with 16 tons, you know? It's like you – come from this place. You wanted to be this person. I got some bad news for you. You are that person. You're not free as a bird anymore. So, I mean, that he sold out. But, you know, he's in advertising.
It's the treatment. My guest is Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. You talk about not recognizing big moments as they happen. And for a lot of the creators who come on and talked about their TV shows here, they say when they hear these things about mythology, they can only see them in the past because they didn't know what they were doing from year to year. They're just trying to get the show up and do the best thing they could with it.
But there's a lot of Coleridge wrote the Xanadu, Kubla Khan, right? And there was there's a whole mythology, a romanticization of writing and creating where you basically – Betty says you hide the brushstrokes, right? It came to me in a dream and then they found 50 pages of notes. He said he took laudanum and wrote that thing. And you look at the rhyme structure and the beats in it and you're like, there's no way this came out of you like that. And so you try – it's part from romanticism. The spirit grabs you and there is a lot of stuff when you're in flow, when you are in it where you say, where did that come from? But it does come from you, and I have an amazing education. I am a repository of other people's pain. I always have been. They tell me things. I've been lucky that strangers have always talked to me. Now even more so because of the show, they come up and relate things to me that I'm just like, wow, that – And as a writer, I always turn around and say, hey, that's a great story. Guess what? That happened to me now because I'm a liar. But I do think that I don't necessarily believe that – I know all about a lot of mythology and I had a really good education and I know a lot about storytelling from reading about storytelling and I know about Jung and I know about – and I also know about, Bugs Bunny and, I worked in sitcoms. I know, I love entertainment and that in the end is the goal. But when it comes down to having to produce a show every week, I always want to write about something I'm interested in. And when people look at the show and they talk about the pace or the look, and I have all these amazing people working with me who are all trying to artistically express the story to their, and they're very talented. But in the end, I'm making something that looks normal to me. It really does. I'm making something. In the end, there's no effort. There's an effort to get it right, but in the end, I'm not like trying to create something new. I'm trying to express something that's already going on in my head. And the sad thing is a lot of times I'm failing and it's not until it's gone for a long time where you look at it and say, oh, that wasn't so bad. But you always feel when you're finished with it like, God, it could have been better or whatever.
It's probably a great place to end it. Thank you so much for doing the show, Matt.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
My guest is Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men and Alf aficionado. Inside joke.
it's true. I am. I love Alf. I say it proudly.
You're the one. The recording engineer here at KCOW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Joanne Dempsey, the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.